think it's appropriate that on Pentecost we're in Hebrews 11. The first song we sang today was Faith of Our Fathers. I don't think we've ever sung that here before, at least not since I've been doing the music. It's a great song. And that's really what chapter 11 of Hebrews is all about. The faith of our fathers and how that they stand as an example for us. You know, as I look at those candles there, I think of the 12 apostles who were faithful to the point of death in proclaiming and fulfilling the mission that Christ sent them on. All of them were killed for their faith except John, and he was persecuted pretty badly. He was tortured and boiled in oil, but he survived. All of those men, including Paul, who suffered a great deal to be faithful to Christ. And Hebrews 11 is all about being faithful to Christ through the good times and through the bad. You may recall that at the end of chapter 10, the apostle talked about that little season, the little season that's still lying ahead of us, where the man of sin is going to be unleashed on the world, and if we live through that, we're going to have to face that time of trial. And in chapter 11, the Apostle Paul gives us this long list of examples of people who have overcome in similar circumstances, and he's given them to us as examples. And many of these, as we go through and look at these individuals and their lives, we're going to see that there are many parallels in what they faced to what Christians are going to face in the end times. And I believe that's why the apostle chose these particular people. But I also want you to look at the end of this chapter, where all this list of famous people from the Old Testament are given. When he goes, at the very end of the chapter, he goes into chapter 12, and he continues to remind them about that end time, those end times. So it's very clear. What we have is we have two bookends for chapter 11. Chapter 11 is all about these people of faith who endured. And in the end of chapter 10, we have him talking about how we have need of endurance, and then he talks about the time of trial that's to come. And then at the end of it, he says the very same thing. Look at chapter 12, verse 1. He says, certainly we also, since having so many documented examples surrounding us, tossing aside every excess load and plaguing sin, should run with endurance the grueling course laying ahead of us. The grueling course laying ahead of us. What is that? It's that time of trial. It's that little season that he talked about in chapter 10. So we can see that the apostle's talking about what we call the Great Tribulation, those end times, both at the beginning and at the end of this list of people of faith. There's no question that he's giving us this list to encourage believers in the last days to overcome. So what we want to do, as we go through these people and we look at their lives briefly, I want you to try to think of ways in which what they experienced would be applicable for Christians who are living during those last few years of the present age just before Christ returns, all right? So you're going to help me with my sermon today. All right, we already covered the first few verses. We talked about Enoch, and we talked about the fact, in verse 5, we talked about the fact of why the apostle might have chosen Enoch to list here for encouragement for believers in the last days who are going to live to see Christ's second coming, because Enoch, the whole point is that Enoch did not see death, but he was caught up without dying. And the Apostle Paul reminds us that many believers are going to actually do that as well. Many believers are going to live until Christ returns, live through the end times, survive those end times, and be caught up without ever dying. The Apostle Paul talks about how the resurrection will affect them, and that is that they will be transformed in the twinkling of an eye. We will put on incorruption. What he's saying is, right, wherever you are on the earth at that moment in time, instantaneously, your body is going to be transformed from what it is now to what it is to be. The same kind of body that people will have once they're resurrected. We talked a lot about the resurrection last week. We read Ezekiel 37 about the bones coming together and the skin put back on the bones and God's breath being breathed into them. God is going to breathe that breath into us who are living as well. I put myself in that group because I hope to be there, not because I know I will be. He's going to breathe that breath of life into us and we're going to be transformed that fast. We won't ever feel death. All of a sudden, you'll just, what happened? Right? Transformed, incorruptible. It's amazing. I believe that's why he put Enoch here. Enoch was a man of faith. He had, and it says that he was documented to have fully pleased God. If you want to be part of that number that doesn't die, it'd probably be a good idea if we fully pleased God, right? Look at the next verse, verse 6. And without faith, it is impossible to fully please God. For the one approaching God must believe that he exists and that he is becoming the benefactor of those who search for him. We have another clue here of what it takes to fully please God. What does it take to fully please God? Faith, yes, but how is this manifest? Fully seek him. Fully seek him. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean? I want you to take your Bibles and go to Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah 55. I want to read verses 6 through 13. If you know anything about Isaiah, you know that chapters 40 through the end of the book are all about that restoration and how God is going to restore the creation. He says in chapter 55, verse 6, "Seek the Lord while he may be found." Now, doesn't that imply that we have a limited time to do that? Doesn't it? Seek the Lord while he may be found, implying that there a time is going to come when you no longer are going to be able to seek the Lord and him be found by you. Seek the Lord while he may be found. Call upon him while he is near, implying that at some point he may be far. At some point you can seek for him all you want and you won't find him. Now how are you going to seek the Lord? Look at verse 7. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. You know, a good portion of Western Christianity has the idea that because I went forward in a church at some point in my life and I said some little prayer or I was baptized, that no matter how I live my life, everything's fine for me. But that's not what the Bible teaches. It is not what the Bible teaches. He says here to let the wicked forsake his way. You want to seek the Lord? He's talking here to Israel, God's people. So the context is he's talking to God's people. So it would apply to us as well. We are God's covenant people. If you want to draw near to God, if you want to seek the Lord, you must forsake your wicked ways. Did you know that the time of trial at the end of this age, do you know why God did that? You know, most of us would think, okay, God saved us, we're going to go live with him. Those who teach that pre-tribulation rapture, what they believe is that, you know, God's not going to allow us to go through any of that suffering, right? He's going to keep us out of all that stuff. And they use this, they typically use this analogy, why would God drag his bride through the mud before the wedding? I've heard that so many times, it makes me want to vomit. He's not dragging his bride before the wedding, but do you know what the Revelation portrays the end time trial with regard to the bride? As a purging of the bride, so that at the end of that time, it says in Revelation 19, the bride has made herself ready. How does a bride get ready? Well, one thing she does is she takes a bath. She washes her clothes, right? She washes her hair. Well, that end time trial is to give us a bath, is to wash our clothes. In fact, it uses those exact words, washing your robes, with regard to those people in the end times. Listen, the trials and the persecution is not being dragged through the mud. The trials and the persecution is being run through the washing machine and the dryer. It's not being dragged through the mud. You've already been dragged through the mud. In fact, the bride very often is tramping around in the mud and playing out in the pigsty. And that's what God has said. He's going to get rid of that before his bride meets him. This is why we have the end time trials. People are going to have to get rid of those things before they face him face to face. He's not going to take a dirty bride. So if you want to know how to seek the Lord, let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts. Let him return to the Lord and he will have mercy on him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Let me tell you something. The degree to which you suffer in the end times very well may be linked to the degree in which you need to be purged. Now, I'm not saying that's the case in all cases. Some people are going to suffer. The apostles certainly didn't need to be purged, but yet they suffered greatly. But I think as an example of faithfulness. But those who need a good cleaning, he's going to give them a good scrubbing, and that might hurt. Keep that in mind as we face the last days. All right, let's get back to Hebrews. Without faith, verse 6, without faith it is impossible to fully please God, for the one approaching God must believe that he exists, that he is becoming the benefactor. That is, the benefactor is the one who bestows things, grace, upon us. He is becoming the benefactor of those who search for him. Let's look at verse 7. Now, as I go through these people, he talks about Noah in verse 7, he talks about Abraham in verse 8, he talks about Sarah in verse 11. I want you to think about the lives of these people that you have learned from the Old Testament scriptures. And I want you to tell me, how does this apply to Christians in the end times that are going to have to face the end time trial? Let's look at Noah, verse 7. By faith, Noah, being apprised about what was yet unknown, being apprehensive, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. Through this he condemned the world, and the heir became just according to faith. Now let me just say one thing about that last statement. The heir became just according to faith. What does that mean? Well, we know that he is constantly referencing the clause, the just shall live by faith, that he quoted from Habakkuk, right? So whenever you see that word just here, and whenever you see the words faith here, he's drawing them from that statement. Now, Noah was a just man, and Noah was a man of faith. Therefore, he's using Noah as an example for us, so that we will be people of faith, and that we will have part in the resurrection as well. How does Noah's life, as it's portrayed here, apply to believers in the end times? Think about it. What did Noah do? What does it say?
He believed judgment was coming. He prepared.
Bingo. Now, God told him judgment was coming, right? We don't know how God told him. It doesn't say whether he heard a voice or he saw a vision. But God did give him a warning. He probably didn't give him much information, but he gave him a warning. And Noah heeded the warning, and he took action to prepare himself. Now, let me ask you a question. Has God given us a warning about the end times?
Once.
Does he expect us to dig into the scriptures, dig into Revelation and other prophecy, and expect us to learn as much as we can so that we can prepare ourselves and our families so that we'll be able to endure that storm? Does he expect us to do that? You better believe he does. That's why he's given us all that information in Revelation. Revelation chapter 12 talks all about how that the woman, remember the woman who was seen with clothed with the sun, the moon under her feet, which is a representation of God's covenant people. And how that the serpent tried to persecute her and she flees into the wilderness where God takes care of her. You're going to have to flee out of our society at some point if you're going to escape the things that are coming in the end times. Jesus said in Matthew 24, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet, flee to the mountains. Get out of town, because it's going to be awful in those places. People who hear his warnings and who take them seriously, and they know what to expect, and they know when to act, and they know what to do when things happen, and they believe the scriptures, and so they actually do take action, those people are going to be a lot better off than those people who are sitting in the pew saying, Jesus is going to come and take me out of here before anything bad happens. Those people are going to be in a world of hurt when things start going on, because they won't know what to do. They're going to be questioning their faith. They're going to be questioning their preachers. They're not going to know what's going on. It's important to study the end times. Jesus gave us a lot of information in the Gospels, and it's there for us. If we're people of faith, we're going to take it seriously. And we're going to watch and pray. That's what Jesus said for us to do. He said, watch, pray, so that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that shall come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. The people who aren't watching and praying because they think none of this has anything to do with them, they're going to be in trouble. All right, now let's look at the next one. So Noah was spared because he took God's warning seriously. He prepared himself and his family, and guess what? He rode out the storm, and he got safely on the other side. Notice the last clause that says he was the heir, becoming just according to faith. Why does he say heir there? Anybody know why? Think of all this in the context of the end times. We are heirs, inheritors of the new world, aren't we? Are we not? When we say the new world or the new age, that is the age to come. Do you know in 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter uses Noah as an example of the end times. And he talks about how that the world that used to exist was destroyed by water. But then he talks about the new world after that, which is the world we live in now. Well, this world is coming to an end, and a new world is to follow here as well. Noah and his sons were the heirs of the world after the flood. Everybody else was destroyed. Right? So they were the heirs after the flood. After the day of the Lord, when Christ and all these plagues come and Christ returns and he destroys the wicked, we are going to be heirs of the new world. The new world. It's not a different planet, but the world is going to be purged by fire just as it was purged by water in Noah's day. Let's go down to verse 8. Let's see how Abraham applies. By faith, Abraham, having been called, obeyed, migrating to the place which he was expecting to receive as an inheritance. And he left, not knowing where he was going. Now, how would that apply to believers in the end times? Here's Abraham. God says, look, I'm going to give you a promised land. You got to get out of here, though. You got to leave here, and you got to go over there. And you're going to have to live in a tent. You're going to have to live in a tent. But I promise you, what you're going to inherit eventually is going to be way better than what you leave. Isn't that right? How would that apply to us? You're going to have to leave everything behind. When it's time to flee, you have to leave your possessions. You're going to have to leave your house. You're going to have to leave all your savings. All that stuff is not going to do you any good. You got to let go of the things of this world. That's what he's saying. That's what Abraham did. He let go. He moved. He left his family. He left his culture, his society. Why did he go? Because God promised him the inheritance. Why will we, when things get bad and we see the signs that Jesus gave, and when Jesus said, when this particular sign happens, that's when you leave. When we see that sign happen, you have a decision to make. You have a decision to make. Am I going to stay here and keep my stuff? Or am I going to leave all of it behind just based on one thing? And that is, God has promised me an inheritance in the kingdom. It comes down to faith. Do you really believe the promises or not? Yes, Jordan?
In Revelation, it talks about people in Jerusalem, Judea, fleeing the mountain. But what about in America? Does it doesn't give a specific spot for us.
It doesn't tell us where to flee. in that passage. Well, actually, he talks about the disciples in Luke 17 when he's talking about fleeing, and he says, remember Lot's wife. Remember that? Remember Lot's wife? Why? Because when Lot was told to get out because God's judgment's coming, right? Get out of the city because God's judgment is coming. It's the same thing. And Jesus said in the days of the Son of Man, it's going to be like it was in the days of Lot. They got out of town. But what happened to Lot's wife? She looked back. She didn't really want to leave, right? And she ended up being destroyed. And Jesus said, when he's talking about his followers leaving, when they see these signs happening, leaving the populated areas, he says, remember Lot's wife. It's in Luke 17. And then the disciples, they're asking him about all this fleeing business, and they say, where, Lord? Where do we flee? Do you remember what Jesus said? Anybody remember what Jesus said? He answered their question. Yeah. Where the body is, the eagles will gather together. It's a hint. It's a clue. You'll know what it means at the proper time. Just keep that verse in your head. Store it away. He was answering the question of where to flee to. Keep that verse in your mind. Don't forget it. All right, let's look at verse 8 again. By faith, Abraham, having been called, obeyed, migrating to the place which he was expecting to receive his inheritance. He left not knowing where he was going. I think Paul put that in there for a good reason. Because when we flee, we may not know ultimately what our destination is at the moment, but we'll find out when we get there. By faith, he lodged in the land of promise as a foreigner living in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the co-heirs of the same promise. You may be living in a tent too, literally. I don't know, but you might. But it'll only be for a little while. Remember, it's a little season until the wrath has passed. Verse 10. Why did Abraham do that? Leave everything behind and go live in a tent? Why did he do that? For he was waiting for the city, having foundations, whose designer and fashioner is God. It says Abraham was waiting for a city. If you go back and read the account of Abraham in Genesis, is there anything in there about Abraham waiting for a city that God is going to build? Is there anything in the Genesis account of him waiting for a city that God is going to build? Yes.
He gives him a promise that he'll have an inheritance.
In the land, yes. Is that a city? It says Abraham was waiting for a city, which means Abraham knew about a city that God is going to build that has foundations. Abraham knew about it. Now, when you read the Genesis account, you don't see anything about a city, except you do see something about a city. Go back to Hebrews chapter 7 for just a moment. In Hebrews 7, verse 1, in these first few verses, he's talking about Abraham. He says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem. Salem is a city. In fact, in Psalm 76:2, it specifically says Salem is Zion, the city of God, that is Jerusalem. And the word Jerusalem comes from two words, Jeru, which means city, and Salem, which means peace. Jerusalem means city of peace. Verse 1, for this Melchizedek, who was king of Salem, that is king of Jerusalem, is the city that God builds Jerusalem? Yes, it is. Priest of God the highest, who met Abraham, returning from the slaughter of the kings, and blessed him, to whom also Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything, is indeed translated, that is, the word Melchizedek is translated king of justice, a title that's applied to Christ in Isaiah. After that, he is called King of Salem, which means King of Peace. He is also the Prince of Peace. He's the King of Salem. Now, Abraham met him. Remember what happened after Abraham met him? Melchizedek blessed Abraham. Doesn't tell us everything he told Abraham, but he blessed Abraham, and then he brought out bread and wine and had communion with Abraham. And then Abraham gave him a tithe of everything. Melchizedek is the king of Jerusalem. Jerusalem didn't even exist at that time. We know that because Abraham later was to go out and offer up Isaac, his son, and he offered Isaac on Mount Moriah, which later became Mount Zion. The Old Testament tells us that Mount Moriah was Mount Zion, ultimately Mount Zion, where Jerusalem was built afterwards. So how did Abraham know about this city? He heard it from Melchizedek. That's how he knew about the city. He met the king who's going to reign in that city. Why does he say having foundations? Don't all cities have foundations? Anybody know? I'll show you why. Look at Isaiah 54. When it's talking about the city of Jerusalem, when it's restored by God, here's what it says. Isaiah 54, we'll start reading in verse 11. O you afflicted one. This whole chapter is about Jerusalem, when God is going to restore it. O you afflicted one, tossed with tempest and not comforted. Behold, I will lay your stones with colorful gems and lay your foundations with sapphires. I will make your pinnacles of rubies, your gates of crystal, and all your walls of precious stones. This remind you of anything in Revelation chapter 21 and 22? Yeah. All your children shall be taught by the Lord, and great shall be the peace of your children. In righteousness you, that is Jerusalem, shall be established. You shall be far from oppression, for you shall not fear, and so forth. He talks about there will be no more terror, and all the things that Jerusalem has endured over the ages, being destroyed time and time again, the Jews being persecuted there, being burned, the temple destroyed, all those things. None of that's going to happen anymore to that city. Let's look at the next one. Verse 11. By faith, Sarah herself received ability to conceive seed, and being beyond the season of childbearing, gave birth, since she deemed faithful the one promising. And through whom also from one whose womb was all but dead were produced accordingly as the constellations of heaven in multitude and as if sand beside the seashore innumerable. As far as Sarah was concerned, it was impossible. In fact, she laughed at the whole idea that she was going to have a child. She laughed. You know, if you were just choosing people randomly out of the Old Testament to say, let's pick the people who we would say had the most faith, you probably wouldn't pick Sarah, right? I mean, there's not much in the Old Testament that points out Sarah's faith. In fact, the fact that she laughed at God's promise makes you want to say, well, maybe she didn't have all that much faith after all, right? But he picks her. Why does he pick her? Because of the parallels here. That's why he's picking these people. Because of the parallels, to be encouragement. Revelation 12, the woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet. It's talking about the offspring of Sarah, which he's talking about here as well. And it talks about her offspring fleeing into the wilderness and being preserved by God. There you have Sarah and all of her offspring, which are mentioned specifically in this passage as well. I want you to notice this. These all died according to faith, not having received the promises, but observing them far ahead. Now, what are the promises that he's talking about here? You tell me. He speaks of them as though his reader should know what promises he's talking about. He's talking about the covenant that God made with Abraham, the promises. God made several promises to Abraham, including he would have a son, including through his seed, which we know Paul says was Christ, all the nations of the world would be blessed, that his seed, who Paul says is Christ, would inherit the land as an everlasting possession, right? All these are the promises that God made to Abraham. But I want you to notice he says that these all died according to faith, not having received the promises, but observing them far ahead. You know what's great about us? Those same promises are for us, which he'll explain here shortly. But we don't have to see them as being so far ahead. I mean, they were thousands of years in the future. from Abraham's day. For us, they're right around the corner. They're right around the corner, which makes it, should make it so much easier even for us. And being persuaded and embracing them. That's a very important statement. All of this that we read about here in Hebrews 11 is all about being persuaded and embracing God's promises. So much so that you're willing to turn loose of absolutely everything else in order to embrace those promises. Being persuaded and embracing them, also acknowledge that they were aliens and foreigners in the land. And that's exactly what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were. They lived out the rest of their lives as foreigners, living in the very land that God said one day would be theirs as an everlasting possession. They're still waiting. Did you know that? Did you know Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob are still waiting for the fulfillment of that promise? You know why they're waiting? Because God is making them wait so that he can include us along with him. In fact, that's how this chapter ends, which we'll see shortly. Let me just finish these couple of verses here. For those, verse 14, for those saying such things demonstrate that they are yearning for the promised homeland. And indeed, if they had been meditating on the land they left behind, they might have had occasion to go back. That is, go back to Babylon where he came from. Yet even now they are craving the better homeland that is under heavenly dominion. Because of this, God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he has prepared the city for them. That is the city that Abraham was looking for. He talks about their frame of mind while they had, after they had removed from Babylon and had gone into the promised land and were living in tents. What he's essentially saying is, while they lived that short time in tents in a foreign land to them, while they did that, you know what they were not doing? They weren't thinking about what they left behind. You remember the children of Israel when God brought them out of Egypt? They were always complaining about this manna. We don't like this manna, right? There's nothing to drink. There's not enough food to eat. We want some meat. We want some of the spices that we had back in Egypt. It was always about what they left behind back in Egypt. And God got so angry with them. That's not the case with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When they left, they did not look back. They did not look back because they were looking ahead. We have to keep looking ahead and not look back like Lot's wife looked back. Keep looking ahead. And what's ahead? The promise is ahead. You know what the big advantage we have over all these people? It's what this chapter starts out by saying. We have all these documented examples. We have the documentation that proves the faithfulness of God to his word. And we have the documented examples of people who live by faith to inspire us. I mean, that's why they're here. They're here to inspire us to repeat their actions, repeat their mindset. Repeat what they did, how they acted. And if we do that, we are going to experience the inheritance, receiving the same promises that they are going to receive.